You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show connecting you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis, standing at the corner of Wilshire Boulevard and Fairfax Avenue. And on this corner, the magic of Hollywood is taking place. Yeah, I know. All right, it's not really Hollywood. This is more like, what, Beverly Hills adjacent, right? But it's where the new Academy Museum of Motion Pictures opens tomorrow, after an epic journey worthy of, well, yeah, a movie. It involves A Faded Star, which is the Art Deco May Company department store on Wilshire Boulevard, and an alien being, a vast concrete and glass sphere. You may have passed this a couple of times on your way from one place to another. Some people call it, well, the Death Star. But anyway, we'll get to that in just a minute. Now, this unlikely pair have been brought together in holy matrimony, a structure that blends old and new by the Italian architect Renzo Piano. Frances Anderton is our design and architecture correspondent. She's here with me right outside of the museum. Hey, Frances.
Hey, Steve. Great to see you here.
We are always sort of the dynamic duo when it comes to architecture. And here we are once again at the corner of Fairfax and Wilshire. And this building is, now we've watched this thing, like, change.
We have. Over many years, it has been quite a journey to get to this point. So there's been a lot of pent-up excitement as to what we're going to be witnessing. Now, currently, you and I, Steve, are looking into, right into the window, of a restaurant called Fanny's, which actually evokes a rather memorable character in the movies, if you know your movies, Barbara Streisand. Anyway, that restaurant is just one piece of this massive change that has occurred here. When the Academy Museum acquired the lease to the May Company building back in 2012, they decided that this was one of the best exhibits that they had in their collection. So they weren't going to relinquish it, as in they weren't going to demolish it. They turned to the architect Renzo Piano, who had already designed two buildings on the LACMA site, BCAM and the Resnick Pavilion, and they brought him on board to help realize a museum that would hold on to the old and would add the new.
Let's go inside, shall we?
Let's. And as you will see, we're entering what is now called the Saban Building, Academy Museum of Motion.
Like the Saban Theater, right?
Like the Saban Theater, but not the May Company. People are used to calling this building the May Company. It's now called the Saban Building. And here we are in the lobby. It's a rather very extremely large lobby area.
This is like Art Deco meets industrial.
Well, that's exactly right. And it's so interesting that you observe that, Steve, because actually what's so interesting about this is that Renzo Piano loves... he loves the mechanics of buildings. He loves sort of exposing the mechanics of buildings. He loves structure. So in fact, when you say industrial, that's kind of the aesthetic that has been chosen for this public sort of concourse space. And in fact, when I asked the Renzo Piano's colleagues about why they chose that aesthetic for this museum, which is about the magic of movies, they said that they want to show the mechanics, just as this museum is showing the mechanics of, or the taking you behind the scenes of how the movies are made.
It looks like a movie set because people are just moving things around with these crates and boxes. And I mean, it's like for, oh, there's a gaffer and a grip and everybody else. It's, you know, boom mic operator. All of those folks are here. And then you look up and I think... I'm reminded of the boat that wasn't big enough.
That's right. You're seeing the first exhibit. And that, of course, is the mechanical shark from Jaws. And Steve, he's looking a little bit hungry. You can really see his teeth from this vantage point.
We're looking. It's actually a little unnerving seeing up there, just levitating from the ceiling.
I know. Seeing his belly that you might wind up inside if you were an unfortunate in Jaws. And in fact, as you can see, they've suspended it in a way that it's right at the top of this escalator and stairwell. So you're looking up through several layers, through several stories. The exhibits lead off of every level as you come up. And the exhibits are self-contained rooms. They have a completely different design team, Y Architecture, that designed them, that didn't do the industrial aesthetic so much. There's lots of color, very sensual, very, very, very vivid, sort of dark spaces that they've brought to life. And what you will find is a mixture of spaces. They're telling kind of different stories about Hollywood, everything from what is it like to be in the mind of Spike Lee? They have sort of worked with him on a exhibit that's devoted totally to Spike Lee, his thoughts, his inspirations, his movies, ditto for Pedro Almodovar. They've also, of course, got tons of artifacts. anything from, the face mask for the Terminator through to a fantastic costume from Black Panther by Ruthie Carter, the Japanese founder of Ghibli Studios, Miyazaki, who is famed for Spirit Away, along with many other movies. They have a whole room devoted to him and his studio. So that's what this is about. It's celebrating process as much as it is the end product. And Piano would say, so's his building. He would say the design of this juxtaposed two structures is also about exposing the way a building is made.
So Francis, why did Renzo Piano decide to keep this building? I mean, L.A. is known for demolishing. I mean, we tear things down. People are angry about tearing the beautiful homes of Bunker Hill in downtown L.A. and all the other buildings, gorgeous buildings from the past. But he didn't do that here. He kept this building.
Well, he kept it in part because the client wanted to keep it, which is the Academy. We should credit LA Conservancy, who had kept it from being demolished back in the early 90s. So anyway, Renzo Piano's worked on old buildings as well as new. He was fully in agreement. But he has a funny way of describing the juxtaposition of the new and the old. He describes it as a flirt between the old and the new.
Flirt between the old lady, the beautiful, nice, loved old ladies, the main component building, and a soap bubble. Yes, a soap bubble.
Now, you heard him mention that this is a soap bubble. In fact, he said it rather emphatically, and that's because people have been calling this building a Death Star, and he doesn't like it. He likes the building to be seen as levitating, as very, very light.
What did it take to reuse and to preserve this May building? Because I'm sure it took a lot to just keep. I mean, it's been here for 80 plus years.
Well, they of course had to intervene in the structure and make sure that it was safe. They also had to get rid of a portion of the west side that had been added. And then of course there was the restoration of the facade that goes onto Wilshire. That's the one we all drive by. That's where you see the gold cylinder that's covered in more than 350,000 24-carat infused gold tiles. And then there's limestone and granite. And that was in very poor condition. And a lot of people said that it was not restorable, that it would be better to just start over. But they wound up finding a restoration architect named John Fiddler, who really believed it could be done.
Oh, yeah.
And he went back to the original makers, the ancient Orsini glassmaking company, to get the replacement tiles, and ditto for the limestone panels and the granite. Now, there was this other really interesting challenge, and that is connecting a completely new structure to a completely old structure in an earthquake region. So, just to get a bit technical here, the new spherical building, the new structure, sitting on base isolators, and they allow the building to move 2.5 feet horizontally in the case of an earthquake. The May Company isn't built that way. It doesn't move. It sits still. So they had to do this clever thing where they connected the building with these bridges, and the bridges themselves are designed in a way that they can slide if there's an earthquake. And the structure, if you look, sort of expresses that. To use an architecty term, it expresses the way in which these move. Luigi Priano from Renzo Piano's office explained that this was part of the overarching concept underlying the scheme.
The metaphor since the beginning of this project was the relationship between the old building and the new building, and so the building that flies and the other building that stays still. And we felt that was even technically showing this and expressing this, how we fight the forces of nature, was going to be another strong point towards that concept.
Whew. So this seems very complicated, and it's taken years. I remember when this was just a sparkle in a few people's eyes. And, you know, it seems so, I mean, you mentioned the earthquake and everything. I mean, it seems so complicated, Francis. Was it, in the end, worth it?
Well, I would argue yes, for a couple of reasons. One is, people love the May Company building. It would have been really sad to lose it. And this way, we've kept a building, even if we've given it a completely different use. Then there's another reason that is becoming more and more essential to the way we think about buildings moving ahead, and that's cost savings and energy savings. For years, we have just built new buildings without really thinking about what their carbon or environmental footprint is. It's becoming increasingly evident, however, that construction and operation of buildings is a big contributor to our carbon footprint. So, in fact, in saving this building, which wound up getting a very high what's called LEED rating, that's a sustainability rating, the saving of this building was factored in. And that's something that's really important going into the future. And also, again, it's always good to save money if you can. So here's the restoration architect, John Fiddler, talking about some savings he was able to make.
I managed to save about 90% of all the building materials on the outside of the construction. All the window frames, all the windows, all that was preserved and restored. It just took a bit of ingenuity to do it.
And you know, the juxtaposition, Francis Anderton, the fact that we're standing here in this old building next to this new soap bubble, that's what we're going to call it, right? And then next door we have the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, which the original building is still there, but all the other buildings that comprised LACMA have been torn down.
Right.
They chose another path next door.
They did. They chose to tear down four buildings, the three original buildings and then a later building from the 1980s, Art of the Americas building, to make way for this new structure by the architect Peter Zumthor. And, you know, along the way, a lot of people said, wouldn't there be cost savings, energy savings in holding onto those four and adapting them? And we were told that it wasn't going to pencil out, it wasn't going to be cheaper. So what Piano and the team have accomplished here at the Academy Museum shows something that's, I think, very, very inspiring, which is that the preservation of buildings doesn't have to be like a literal restoration of an old building, taking it back to exactly the way it was. No, here he's managed to combine the old and the new in a way that just reinvents the building. So it conserves as well as not being just an old lady from the past, it goes beaming into the future with the additions that have been made, with the reuse of the interior. We have tons of buildings which could be inventively reused in that way. It holds onto memories, it creates new memories. I think it's very exciting, and I hope it's a model for the future.
Well, its premiere, as it were, is tomorrow. Francis Anderton, our design and architecture expert and correspondent here on Greater LA. Francis, as always, it's nice to look around and see wonderful things with you.
I love going on these tours with you, Steve.
Well, the Academy Museum is one thing that we're focusing on today on KCRW's Greater LA. We'll get to a new pinata exhibit and even meet a third-generation pinata maker coming up on the program in just a few moments. But I do want to take a minute or two and remind you about the public radio fundraising formula. It's a little different from how the other folks do it. You hear minutes upon minutes of ads on commercial radio stations, you know, think K-Rock or KNX, because those are what we call commercial radio stations. And what they do is fine. That's their model. Ours is specific to the people who listen. We encourage you to cross the threshold and support individually the programs that you use and enjoy, the podcasts and music shows that you seek and that you utilize. That's our formula. That's how we raise money to provide you what we do. How important is the service to you? Well, all we ask is that you put a value to it. $10, $20, $32 a month. A one-time gift, maybe, of $120. Whatever you can afford, what's right for you, that's all we ask at kcrw.com/give. It's the last day of KCRW's good old-fashioned pledge drive. Get in before it's all over. kcrw.com/give. And thank you for your support. Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. If you're like me, when you see a pinata, you get the urge to grab a stick, right, and start swinging. But some pinatas aren't just designed to be hacked into pieces, spraying candy everywhere for the kids and maybe even for the grown-ups, too, to pick up. Those pinatas can be works of art. Well, now LA is getting its first ever pinata exhibition at Craft in America. That's a gallery on 3rd Street in Mid-City. And to tell us more about the show that's called Pinatas, the High Art of Celebration, the director and lead curator, Emily Zaden, is here. Emily, welcome to you.
Thank you so much. Such a pleasure.
And Yesenia Prieto is one of the artists whose work is featured in the exhibit. Yesenia, welcome to you as well.
Hi there. Pleasure to be here.
Emily, I'm going to start with you. The question is, what inspired you to create an exhibit out of something that so many folks want to destroy, that, you know, is sort of part of the Mexican-American fabric?
That's right. It is so much a part of our lives. And I think it was partially that they're a part of all of our lives, that it crosses cultures. Living here in Southern California, piñatas are just a part of celebrations of all kinds, birthday parties. Every kid has an important memory, I think, at this point. So there's the beauty of that, that it stems from this Mexican tradition and that it's become so widespread. And also that these are handcrafted objects that are beautiful, creatively designed, made with care and love, and also that, yes, we discard, but the idea that really we should recognize that these are artistic objects and that they've been generally overlooked in terms of museums and galleries previously, but that these are around us and they make all of these important moments in people's lives so marked by celebration, and really it came from that.
Yesenia, you're a third-generation piñata maker. Talk a little bit about your family and where you learned this craft.
I am a third-generation maker. My family is from South Central Los Angeles. My tia would always used to say, we were one of the first families to bring piñatas to Los Angeles and stuff like that growing up. It was a crazy environment to, like, grow up in, because it was just a bunch of cardboard everywhere, a bunch of glue everywhere. It's definitely a messy and intensive, like, trade. So, like, as a kid, we would just help with little things here and there, like coloring eyes and, like, helping my grandparents and my tias and my cousins. Like, we'd all work together, like, transporting things, but It was fun, you know. We were working from our house, and so it was just like piñatas all over in every room, you know.
Do you design each one of them that you sell? I mean, are they your own creation?
Right now, yes. I would say like 99% of the pieces that we are making here in the studio are all designed by us, and sometimes we do get specifications by a client where we have to meet an exact standard, and of course we guide our clients through these things, so we do have a large input into like the final design. I think it's just because it's such a new thing, you know, people aren't used to like custom piñatas. I'm like, oh my god, what is that, you know, what can I do with that? And I'm like, well, you can do this and this and this and that, you know. So it is like something we do design, even if we are working off of someone else's vision.
You say it's a new thing as far as your unique designs and things like that. But Emily, it's obviously an old history. The history of piñatas dates back centuries. I mean, it has roots in Mexico. You've spent years researching this, trying to put this exhibit together. I mean, what can you tell us about not only where it comes from, but how it evolved into what it is today?
So maybe it's not a surprise. The history of piñatas has not yet been published. It hasn't been documented, but it's really folklore and oral tradition that people are piecing together probably what happened, and that it began in China in terms of holiday celebrations with objects that were either made of paper or clay that were shattered at various holiday functions, and that potentially people believe that Marco Polo and all kinds of explorers to China brought that tradition back to Western Europe, to Spain and to Italy. And then in terms of migrating to South Central North America, missionaries most likely brought it from Spain to Mexico and to all of Central America. and used it really as a tool for indoctrination. They were used for all kinds of ceremonies and festivities. People would be blinded, put with a blindfold over their faces, and then would swat at piñatas that were then generally made also of ceramics. And, of course, the shards would go flying everywhere. It's also...
Something tells me there was no candy in there, though, at the time.
There probably were some kind of treats, certainly, to...
Really?
Oh, yes. Certainly to reinforce that indoctrination process. That started way back when as well. And on, even going back to China, those were often filled with money, if not candy or some kind of food, and sometimes also made as offerings to the deceased. You would smash one, it would be filled with treats for the dead, essentially. So there's all these amazing cultural histories to it that come from really all over the world, which is part of the beauty of what they are today. And then we arrive to the tradition becoming so widespread and popular in Mexico, onward into the U.S., and it being adopted here and popularized here all across the country, of course. I mean, you can buy piñatas now at Target.
Yesenia, what does it mean to you that these are now, I mean, you say that it sort of evolved for you. You know, what does it mean for you to have it acknowledged as an art form in this exhibit?
It's huge, honestly. I've always known from a young age, like, I had a very good understanding of art. You know, my father was a sculptor, and he did a lot of fine art sculptures. And my mother's side was into the piñatas. And if anything, I've come to find that some of the processes of making piñatas, as much as people don't really know, it's so involved, meaning you have to learn so many different types of mediums, meaning painting, graphic design, you have to understand different adhesives, you have to understand different kinds of paper, different kinds of cardboard, how do you add texture, and... Furthermore, with this art form, not only is it something that that's visually like an artistic representation of what the artist is trying to do, but it also lends its way being that it creates an experience. And then if we even take it a step further, these experiences are symbolic. They're like, they pave the pathway to creating or saying and sending a statement, a larger statement. And for me, that's like... Everything that, you know, is recognized as art, like, you know, it's beautiful, it sends a message, it makes you feel something, it brings people together. All those elements are involved in what we do. People haven't been seeing piñatas in their like truest form, mostly I would say, just because we're always having to work so fast that a lot of these makers, it's like we don't get a chance to showcase our work in its, like, highest quality, you know, because we're trying to make ends meet. And then when we're starting to compete with mass production, our essence is somewhat starting to get lost. So seeing this and having this platform is a huge deal. It's a huge deal because there's so many people in this industry that are artists and they are doing this and they're not getting recognized for that when they deserve to be. For so many reasons.
Well, the show is up now over at Craft in America through December 4th. I hope you'll check it out. It seems wonderful. And again, when you see all those piñatas and you see the designs and the colors, just seems so cool. Yesenia Prieto, founder of Piñata Design Studio. Emily Zaden, director and lead curator over at Craft in America. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for today. Tomorrow, now that there's a vaccine mandate about to take effect to enter bars in LA, the city is considering the same for restaurants. You're going to hear reactions from business owners, workers, customers. Hope you'll come back for tomorrow's episode of GLA. Thank you for coming back today and every day for the programs and the podcasts on KCRW that you use. It is the final day of KCRW's good old-fashioned pledge drive. A mission to raise the money we need to operate this radio station, the one that you use and have supported with your ears, and maybe even money, too, in the past. There is no time like right now, to show what you stand for, to bolster the station that's provided you with news and music and culture for generations. As connected to LA as ever, we try to embody the spirit of this great place. How much does that mean to you? How often do you listen and use the services that we provide? That's why we ask you to put a dollar value to it, whether it be 10 or 20 bucks a month, maybe $32 a month, a one-time gift, whatever you can afford. We have a $25,000 challenge grant to encourage you to give. Thanks to KCRW board member Heather Minkst and Tyler Minkst, we appreciate it if you rose to this ambitious challenge as well. KCRW.com/give. And thank you. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Guys, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordall all help make the show happen tonight. I'm Steve Chitakis, honored by your presence. Have a great night.